had stood for the most strenuous and eloquent champion of the Greek Church. And if the apostate, the bastard, was reprobated by his country, he appears in ecclesiastical story, a rare example of a patriot who was recommended to court favor by loud opposition and well-timed compliance. With the aid of his two spiritual coadjutors, the emperor applied his arguments to the general situation and personal characters of the bishops, and each was successively moved by authority and example. Their revenues were in the hands of the Turks, their persons in those of the Latins. An episcopal treasure, 3 robes and 40 ducats, was soon exhausted. The hopes of their return still depended on the ships of Venice and the alms of Rome, and such was their indigence that their arrears, the payments of a debt, would be accepted as a favor and might operate as a bribe. The danger and relief of Constantinople might excuse some prudent and pious dissimulation, and it was insinuated that the obstinate heretics who should resist the consent of the East and West would be abandoned in a hostile land to the revenge or justice of the Roman pontiff. In the first private assembly of the Greeks, the formulary of union was approved by 24 and rejected by 12 members. But the 5 cross-bearers of Santa Sophia, who aspired to represent the patriarch, were disqualified by ancient discipline, and their right of voting was transferred to the obsequious train of monks, grammarians, and profane laymen. The will of the monarch produced a false and servile unanimity, and no more than 2 patriots had courage to speak their own sentiments and those of their country. Demetrius, the emperor's brother, retired to Venice that he might not be witness of the union, and Mark of Ephesus, mistaking perhaps his pride for his conscience, disclaimed all communion with the Latin heretics, and avowed himself the champion and confessor of the Orthodox creed. In the treaty between the two nations, several forms of consent were proposed, such as might satisfy the Latins without dishonoring the Greeks, and they weighed the scruples of words and syllables till the theological balance trembled with a slight preponderance in favor of the Vatican. It was agreed, I must entreat the attention of the reader, that the Holy Ghost proceeds from the Father and the Son, as from one principle and one substance, that he proceeds by the Son, being of the same nature and substance, and that he proceeds from the Father and the Son by one spiration and production. It is less difficult to understand the articles of the preliminary treaty, that the Pope should defray all the expenses of the Greeks in their return home, and that he should annually maintain 2 galleys and 300 soldiers for the defense of Constantinople, that all the ships which transported pilgrims to Jerusalem should be obliged to touch at that port, that as often as they were required, the Pope should furnish 10 galleys for a year, or 20 for 6 months, and that he should powerfully solicit the princes of Europe if the Emperor had occasion for land forces. The same year, and almost the same day, were marked by the deposition of Eugenius at Basel, and at Florence by his reunion of the Greeks and Latins. Then the former synod, which he styled indeed an assembly of demons, the Pope was branded with the guilt of simony, perjury, tyranny, heresy, and schism, and declared to be incorrigible in his vices, unworthy of any title, and incapable of holding any ecclesiastical office. In the latter, he was revered as the true and holy vicar of Christ, who, after a separation of 600 years, had reconciled the Catholics of the East and West in one fold and under one shepherd. The act of union was subscribed by the Pope, the Emperor, and the principal members of both churches, even by those who, like Seropulus, had been deprived of the right of voting. 2 copies might have sufficed for the East and West, but Eugenius was not satisfied unless Four authentic and similar transcripts were signed and attested as the monuments of his victory. On a memorable day, the 6th of July, the successors of St. Peter and Constantine ascended their thrones. The two nations assembled in the Cathedral of Florence. Their representatives, Cardinal Julian and Bessarion, Archbishop of Nice, appeared in the pulpit, and after reading in their respective tongues the Act of Union, they mutually embraced, in the name and the presence of their applauding brethren. The Pope and his ministers then officiated according to the Roman liturgy. The creed was chanted with the addition of filioque. The acquiescence of the Greeks was poorly excused by their ignorance of the harmonious but inarticulate sounds, and the more scrupulous Latins refused any public celebration of the Byzantine rite. Yet the emperor and his clergy were not totally unmindful of national honor. The treaty was ratified by their consent. It was tacitly agreed that no innovation should be attempted in their creed or ceremonies. They spared, and secretly respected, the generous firmness of Mark of Ephesus, and on the decease of the patriarch, they refused to elect his successor, except in the Cathedral of Santa Sophia. In the distribution of public and private rewards, the liberal pontiff exceeded their hopes and his promises. The Greeks, with less pomp and pride, returned by the same road of Ferrara and Venice, and their reception at Constantinople was such as will be described in the following chapter. The success of the first trial encouraged Eugenius to repeat the same edifying scenes. And the deputies of the Armenians, the Maronites, the Jacobites of Syria and Egypt, the Nestorians and the Ethiopians, were successively introduced to kiss the feet of the Roman pontiff and to announce the obedience and the orthodoxy of the East. These Oriental embassies, unknown in the countries which they presumed to represent, diffused over the West the fame of Eugenius, and a clamour was artfully propagated against the remnant of a schism in Switzerland and Savoy, which alone impeded the harmony of the Christian world. The vigour of opposition was succeeded by the lassitude of despair. The Council of Basel was silently dissolved, and Felix, renouncing the tiara, again withdrew to the devout or delicious hermitage of Rapallo. A general peace was secured by mutual acts of oblivion and indemnity. All ideas of reformation subsided. The popes continued to exercise and abuse their ecclesiastical despotism. Nor has Rome been since disturbed by the mischiefs of a contested election. The journeys of three emperors were unavailing for their temporal or perhaps their spiritual salvation, but they were productive of a beneficial consequence, the revival of the Greek learning in Italy, from whence it was propagated to the last nations of the West and North. In their lowest servitude and depression, the subjects of the Byzantine throne were still possessed of a golden key that could unlock the treasures of antiquity, of a musical and prolific language that gives a soul to the objects of sense and a body to the abstractions of philosophy. Since the barriers of the monarchy and even of the capital had been trampled underfoot, the various barbarians had doubtless corrupted the form and substance of the national dialect, and ample glossaries have been composed to interpret a multitude of words of Arabic, Turkish, Sclavonian, Latin, or French origin. But a purer idiom was spoken in the court and taught in the college, and the flourishing state of the language is described and perhaps embellished by a learned Italian, who, by long residence and noble marriage, was naturalized at Constantinople about 30 years before the Turkish conquest. "The vulgar speech," says Philelphus, "has been depraved by the people and infected by the multitude of strangers and merchants who every day flock to the city and mingle with the inhabitants. It is from the disciples of such a school that the Latin language received the versions of Aristotle and Plato, so obscure in sense and in spirit so poor. But the Greeks who have escaped the contagion are those whom we follow, and they alone are worthy of our imitation. In familiar discourse they still speak the tongue of Aristophanes and Euripides, of the historians and philosophers of Athens, and the style of their writings is still more elaborate and correct. The persons who, by their birth and offices, are attached to the Byzantine court, are those who maintain, with the least alloy, the ancient standard of elegance and purity, and the native graces of language most conspicuously shine among the noble matrons, who are excluded from all intercourse with foreigners. With foreigners, do I say? They live retired and sequestered from the eyes of their fellow citizens. Seldom are they seen in the streets, and when they leave their houses, it is in the dusk of evening, on visits to the churches and their nearest kindred. On these occasions they are on horseback, covered with a veil, and encompassed by their parents, their husbands, or their servants. Among the Greeks, a numerous and opulent clergy was dedicated to the service of religion. Their monks and bishops have ever been distinguished by the gravity and austerity of their manners, nor were they diverted, like the Latin priests, by the pursuits and pleasures of a secular and even military life. After a large deduction for the time and talent that were lost in the devotion, the laziness, and the discord of the church and cloister, the more inquisitive and ambitious minds would explore the sacred and profane erudition of their native language. The ecclesiastics presided over the education of youth. The schools of philosophy and eloquence were perpetuated till the fall of the empire. And it may be affirmed that more books and more knowledge were included within the walls of Constantinople than could be dispersed over the extensive countries of the West. But an important distinction has been already noticed. The Greeks were stationary, or retrograde, while the Latins were advancing with a rapid and progressive motion. The nations were excited by the spirit of independence and emulation, and even the little world of the Italian states contained more people and industry than the decreasing circle of the Byzantine Empire. In Europe, the lower ranks of society were relieved from the yoke of feudal servitude, and freedom is the first step to curiosity and knowledge. The use, however rude and corrupt, of the Latin tongue had been preserved by superstition. The universities, from Bologna to Oxford, were peopled with thousands of scholars, and their misguided ardor might be directed to more liberal and manly studies. In the resurrection of science, Italy was the first that cast away her shroud, and the eloquent Petrarch, by his lessons and his example, may justly be applauded as the first harbinger of day. A purer style of composition, a more generous and rational strain of sentiment, flowed from the study and imitation of the writers of ancient Rome, and the disciples of Cicero and Virgil approached with reverence and love the sanctuary of their Grecian masters. In the sack of Constantinople, the French and even the Venetians had despised and destroyed the works of Lysippus and Homer. The monuments of art may be annihilated by a single blow, but the immortal mind is renewed and multiplied by the copies of the pen, and such copies it was the ambition of Petrarch and his friends to possess and understand. The arms of the Turks undoubtedly pressed the flight of the Muses, yet we may tremble at the thought that Greece might have been overwhelmed with her schools and libraries before Europe had emerged from the deluge of barbarism, that the seeds of science might have been scattered by the winds before the Italian soil was prepared for their cultivation. The most learned Italians of the 15th century have confessed and applauded the restoration of Greek literature after a long oblivion of many hundred years. Yet in that country and beyond the Alps, some names are quoted. Some profound scholars, who in the darker ages were honorably distinguished by their knowledge of the Greek tongue. A national vanity has been loud in the praise of such rare examples of erudition. Without scrutinizing the merit of individuals, truth must observe that their science is without a cause and without an effect, that it was easy for them to satisfy themselves and their more ignorant contemporaries, and that the idiom which they had so marvelously acquired was transcribed in few manuscripts and was not taught in any university of the West. In a corner of Italy, it faintly existed as the popular, or at least as the ecclesiastical, dialect. The first impression of the Doric and Ionic colonies has never been completely erased. The Calabrian churches were long attached to the throne of Constantinople, and the monks of St. Basil pursued their studies in Mount Athos and the schools of the East. Calabria was the native country of Balaam, who has already appeared as a sectary and an ambassador. And Balaam was the first who revived, beyond the Alps, the memory, or at least the writings, of Homer. He is described by Petrarch and Boccaccio as a man of diminutive stature, though truly great in the measure of learning and genius, of a piercing discernment, though of a slow and painful elocution. For many ages, as they affirm, Greece had not produced his equal in the knowledge of history, grammar, and philosophy, and his merit was celebrated in the attestations of the princes and doctors of Constantinople. One of these attestations is still extant, and the emperor Cantacuzini, the protector of his adversaries, is forced to allow that Euclid, Aristotle, and Plato were familiar to that profound and subtle logician. In the court of Avignon, he formed an intimate connection with Petrarch, the first of the Latin scholars, and the desire of mutual instruction was the principle of their literary commerce. The Tuscan applied himself with eager curiosity and assiduous diligence to the study of the Greek language, and in a laborious struggle with the dryness and difficulty of the first rudiments, he began to reach the sense and to feel the spirit of poets and philosophers whose minds were congenial to his own. But he was soon deprived of the society and lessons of this useful assistant. Balaam relinquished his fruitless embassy, and on his return to Greece he rashly provoked the swarms of fanatic monks by attempting to substitute the light of reason to that of their navel. After a separation of 3 years, the two friends again met in the court of Naples, but the generous pupil renounced the fairest occasion of improvement, and by his recommendation Balaam was finally settled in a small bishopric of his native Calabria. The manifold avocations of Petrarch, love and friendship, his various correspondence and frequent journeys, the Roman laurel, and his elaborate compositions in prose and verse in Latin and Italian, diverted him from a foreign idiom. And as he advanced in life, the attainment of the Greek language was the object of his wishes rather than of his hopes. When he was about 50 years of age, a Byzantine ambassador, his friend, and a master of both tongues, presented him with a copy of Homer. And the answer of Petrarch is at one expressive of his eloquence, gratitude, and regret. After celebrating the generosity of the donor and the value of a gift more precious in his estimation than gold or rubies, he thus proceeds. Your present of the genuine and original text of the divine poet, the fountain of all inventions, is worthy of yourself and of me. You have fulfilled your promise and satisfied my desires. Yet your liberality is still imperfect. With Homer, you should have given me yourself, a guide who could lead me into the fields of light and disclose to my wondering eyes the spacious miracles of the Iliad and Odyssey. But alas, Homer is dumb, or I am deaf, nor is it in my power to enjoy the beauty which I possess. I have seated him by the side of Plato, the prince of poets, near the prince of philosophers, and I glory in the sight of my illustrious guests. Of their immortal writings, whatever had been translated into the Latin idiom, I had already acquired. But if there be no profit, there is some pleasure in beholding these venerable Greeks in their proper and national habit. I am delighted with the aspect of Homer, and as often as I embrace the silent volume, I exclaim with a sigh, "Illustrious bard, with what pleasure should I listen to thy song if my sense of hearing were not obstructed and lost by the death of one friend, and in the much lamented absence of another? Nor do I yet despair, and the example of Cato suggests some comfort and hope, since it was in the last period of age that he attained the knowledge of the Greek letters." The prize which eluded the efforts of Petrarch was obtained by the fortune and industry of his friend Boccaccio, the father of the Tuscan prose. That popular writer, who derives his reputation from the Decameron, 100 novels of pleasantry and love, may aspire to the more serious praise of restoring, in Italy, the study of the Greek language. In the year 1360, a disciple of Balaam, whose name was Leo, or Leontius Pilatus, was detained in his way to Avignon by the advice and hospitality of Boccaccio, who lodged the stranger in his house, prevailed on the Republic of Florence to allow him an annual stipend, and devoted his leisure to the first Greek professor who taught that language in the western countries of Europe. The appearance of Leo might disgust the most eager disciple. He was clothed in the mantle of a philosopher, or a mendicant. His countenance was hideous. His face was overshadowed with black hair, his beard long and uncombed, his deportment rustic, his temper gloomy and inconstant. Nor could he grace his discourse with the ornaments or even the perspicuity of Latin elocution. But his mind was stored with a treasure of Greek learning. History and fable, philosophy and grammar, were alike at his command, and he read the poems of Homer in the schools of Florence. It was from his explanation that Boccaccio composed and transcribed a literal prose version of the Iliad and Odyssey, which satisfied the thirst of his friend Petrarch, and which, perhaps in the succeeding century, was clandestinely used by Laurentius Valla, the Latin interpreter. It was from his narratives that the same Boccaccio collected the materials for his treatise on the genealogy of the heathen gods, a work in that age of stupendous erudition, and which he ostentatiously sprinkled with Greek characters and passages to excite the wonder and applause of his more ignorant readers. The first steps of learning are slow and laborious. No more than 10 votaries of Homer could be enumerated in all Italy, and neither Rome, nor Venice, nor Naples could add a single name to this studious catalogue. But their numbers would have multiplied, their progress would have been accelerated, if the inconstant Leo at the end of 3 years had not relinquished an honourable and beneficial station. In his passage, Petrarch entertained him at Padua a short time. He enjoyed the scholar, but was justly offended with the gloomy and unsocial temper of the man. Discontented with the world and with himself, Leo deprecated his present enjoyments, while absent persons and objects were dear to his imagination. In Italy he was a Thessalian, In Greece, a native of Calabria, in the company of the Latins, he disdained their language, religion, and manners. No sooner was he landed at Constantinople than he again sighed for the wealth of Venice and the elegance of Florence. His Italian friends were deaf to his importunity. He depended on their curiosity and indulgence, and embarked on a second voyage. But on his entrance into the Adriatic, the ship was assaulted by a tempest, and the unfortunate teacher, who, like Ulysses, had fastened himself to the mast, was struck dead by a flash of lightning. The humane Petrarch dropped a tear on his disaster, but he was most anxious to learn whether some copy of Euripides or Sophocles might not be saved from the hands of the mariners. But the faint rudiments of Greek learning, which Petrarch had encouraged and Boccaccio had planted, soon withered and expired. The succeeding generation was content for a while with the improvement of Latin eloquence, nor was it before the end of the 14th century that a new and perpetual flame was rekindled in Italy. Previous to his own journey, the Emperor Manuel dispatched his envoys and orators to implore the compassion of the Western princes. Of these envoys, the most conspicuous, or the most learned, was Manuel Chrysoloras, of noble birth, and whose Roman ancestors are supposed to have migrated with the great Constantine. After visiting the courts of France and England, where he obtained some contributions and more promises, the envoy was invited to assume the office of a professor, and Florence had, again, the honour of this second invitation. By his knowledge not only of the Greek but of the Latin tongue, Chrysoloras deserved the stipend and surpassed the expectation of the Republic. His school was frequented by a crowd of disciples of every rank and age, and one of these, in a general history, has described his motives and his success. "At that time," says Leonard Aretin, "I was a student of the civil law, but my soul was inflamed with the love of letters, and I bestowed some application on the sciences of logic and rhetoric. On the arrival of Manuel, I hesitated whether I should desert my legal studies or relinquish this golden opportunity, and thus, in the ardor of youth, I communed with my own mind. Wilt thou be wanting to thyself and thy fortune? Wilt thou refuse to be introduced to a familiar converse with Homer, Plato, and Demosthenes? With those poets, philosophers, and orators, of whom such wonders are related, and who are celebrated by every age as the great masters of human science? Of professors and scholars in civil law, a sufficient supply will always be found in our universities. But a teacher, and such a teacher of the Greek language, if he once be suffered to escape, may never afterwards be retrieved. Convinced by these reasons, I gave myself to Chrysoloras, and so strong was my passion that the lessons which I had imbibed in the day were the constant object of my nightly dreams." At the same time and place, the Latin classics were explained by John of Ravenna, the domestic pupil of Petrarch. The Italians, who illustrated their age and country, were formed in this double school, and Florence became the fruitful seminary of Greek and Roman erudition. The presence of the emperor recalled Chrysoloras from the college to the court, but he afterwards taught at Pavia and Rome with equal industry and applause. The remainder of his life, about 15 years, was divided between Italy and Constantinople, between embassies and lessons. In the noble office of enlightening a foreign nation, the grammarian was not unmindful of a more sacred duty to his prince and country, and Emmanuel Chrysoloras died at Constance on a public mission from the emperor to the council. After his example, the restoration of the Greek letters in Italy was prosecuted by a series of emigrants who were destitute of fortune and endowed with learning, or at least with language. From the terror or oppression of the Turkish arms, the natives of Thessalonica and Constantinople escaped to a land of freedom, curiosity, and wealth. The synod introduced into Florence the lights of the Greek church and the oracles of the Platonic philosophy. And the fugitives who adhered to the union had the double merit of renouncing their country, not only for the Christian, but for the Catholic cause. A patriot who sacrifices his party and conscience to the allurements of favor may be possessed, however, of the private and social virtues. He no longer hears the reproachful epithets of slave and apostate. And the consideration which he acquires among his new associates will restore in his own eyes the dignity of his character. The prudent conformity of Bessarion was rewarded with the Roman purple. He fixed his residence in Italy, and the Greek cardinal, the titular patriarch of Constantinople, was respected as the chief and protector of his nation. His abilities were exercised in the legations of Bologna, Venice, Germany, and France, and his election to the chair of St. Peter floated for a moment on the uncertain breath of a conclave. His ecclesiastical honors diffused a splendor and preeminence over the literary merit and service. His palace was a school. As often as the cardinal visited the Vatican, he was attended by a learned train of both nations, of men applauded by themselves and the public, and whose writings, now overspread with dust, were popular and useful in their own times. I shall not attempt to enumerate the restorers of Grecian literature in the 15th century, and it may be sufficient to mention with gratitude the names of Theodore Gaza, of George of Trebizond, of John Argyropoulos, and Demetrius Chalconcondyles, who taught their native language in the schools of Florence and Rome. Their labors were not inferior to those of Bessarion, whose purple they revered, and whose fortune was the secret object of their envy. But the lives of these grammarians were humble and obscure. They had declined the lucrative paths of the church. Their dress and manners secluded them from the commerce of the world, and since they were confined to the merit, they might be content with the rewards of learning. From this character, Janus Lascaris will deserve an exception. His eloquence, politeness, and imperial descent recommended him to the French monarch, and in the same cities he was alternately employed to teach and to negotiate. Duty and interest prompted them to cultivate the study of the Latin language, and the most successful attained the faculty of writing and speaking with fluency and elegance in a foreign idiom. But they ever retained the inveterate vanity of their country. Their praise, or at least their esteem, was reserved for the national writers to whom they owed their fame and subsistence, and they sometimes betrayed their contempt in licentious criticism or satire on Virgil's poetry and the oratory of Tully. The superiority of these masters arose from the familiar use of a living language, and their first disciples were incapable of discerning how far they had degenerated from the knowledge and even the practice of their ancestors. A vicious pronunciation, which they introduced, was banished from the schools by the reason of the succeeding age. Of the power of the Greek accents they were ignorant. And those musical notes, which from an Attic tongue and to an Attic ear must have been the secret soul of harmony, were, to their eyes, as to our own, no more than minute and unmeaning marks, in prose superfluous and troublesome in verse. The art of grammar they truly possessed. The valuable fragments of Apollonius and Herodian were transfused into their lessons, and their treatises of syntax and etymology, though devoid of philosophic spirit, are still useful to the Greek student. In the shipwreck of the Byzantine libraries, each fugitive seized a fragment of treasure, a copy of some author who, without his industry, might have perished. The transcripts were multiplied by an assiduous and sometimes an elegant pen, and the text was corrected and explained by their own comments, or those of the elder scholiasts. The sense, though not the spirit, of the Greek classics was interpreted to the Latin world. The beauties of style evaporate in a version, but the judgment of Theodore Gaza selected the more solid works of Aristotle and Theophrastus, and their natural histories of animals and plants opened a rich fund of genuine and experimental science. Yet the fleeting shadows of metaphysics were pursued with more curiosity and ardor. After a long oblivion, Plato was revived in Italy by a venerable Greek, who taught in the house of Cosmo of Medici. While the Synod of Florence was involved in theological debate, some beneficial consequences might flow from the study of his elegant philosophy. His style is the purest standard of the Attic dialect, and his sublime thoughts are sometimes adapted to familiar conversation, and sometimes adorned with the richest colors of poetry and eloquence. The dialogues of Plato are a dramatic picture of the life and death of a sage, and as often as he descends from the clouds, his moral system inculcates the love of truth, of our country, and of mankind. The precept and example of Socrates recommended a modest doubt and liberal inquiry, and if the Platonists, with blind devotion, adored the visions and errors of their divine master, their enthusiasm might correct the dry, dogmatic method of the peripatetic school. So equal, yet so opposite, are the merits of Plato and Aristotle that they may be balanced in endless controversy. But some spark of freedom may be produced by the collision of adverse servitude. The modern Greeks were divided between the two sects. With more fury than skill, they fought under the banner of their leaders, and the field of battle was removed in their flight from Constantinople to Rome. But this philosophical debate soon degenerated into an angry and personal quarrel of grammarians. And Bessarion, though an advocate for Plato, protected the national honor by interposing the advice and authority of a mediator. In the gardens of the Medici, the academical doctrine was enjoyed by the polite and learned. But their philosophic society was quickly dissolved, and if the writings of the Attic sage were perused in the closet, the more powerful Stagirite continued to reign the oracle of the church and school. I have fairly represented the literary merits of the Greeks, yet it must be confessed that they were seconded and surpassed by the ardor of the Latins. Italy was divided into many independent states, and at that time it was the ambition of princes and republics to vie with each other in the encouragement and reward of literature. The fame of Nicholas V has not been adequate to his merits. From a plebeian origin he raised himself by his virtue and learning. The character of the man prevailed over the interest of the Pope, and he sharpened those weapons which were soon pointed against the Roman Church. He had been the friend of the most eminent scholars of the age. He became their patron, and such was the humility of his manners that the change was scarcely discernible either to them or to himself. If he pressed the acceptance of a liberal gift, it was not as the measure of desert, but as the proof of benevolence, and when modest merit declined his bounty, "Accept it," would he say, with a consciousness of his own worth. "Ye will not always have a Nicholas among you." The influence of the Holy See pervaded Christendom, and he exerted that influence in the search not of benefices, but of books. from the ruins of the Byzantine libraries, from the darkest monasteries of Germany and Britain. He collected the dusty manuscripts of the writers of antiquity, and wherever the original could not be removed, a faithful copy was transcribed and transmitted for his use. The Vatican, the old repository for bulls and legends, for superstition and forgery, was daily replenished with more precious furniture. And such was the industry of Nicholas that in a reign of 8 years he formed a library of 5,000 volumes. To his munificence the Latin world was indebted for the versions of Xenophon, Diodorus, Polybius, Thucydides, Herodotus, and Appian, of Strabo's geography, of the Iliad, of the most valuable works of Plato and Aristotle, of Ptolemy and Theophrastus, and of the fathers of the Greek Church. The example of the Roman pontiff was preceded or imitated by Florentine merchant, who governed the republic without arms and without a title. Cosimo of Medici was the father of a line of princes whose name and age are almost synonymous with the restoration of learning. His credit was ennobled into fame. His riches were dedicated to the service of mankind. He corresponded at once with Cairo and London, and a cargo of Indian spices and Greek books was often imported in the same vessel. The genius and education of his grandson Lorenzo rendered him not only a patron, but a judge and candidate in the literary race. In his palace, distress was entitled to relief and merit to reward. His leisure hours were delightfully spent in the Platonic Academy. He encouraged the emulation of Demetrius Chalcondyles and Angelo Politian, and his active missionary, Janus Lascaris, returned from the East with a treasure of 200 manuscripts, 80 of which were as yet unknown in the libraries of Europe. The rest of Italy was animated by a similar spirit, and the progress of the nation repaid the liberality of their princes. The Latins held the exclusive property of their own literature, and these disciples of Greece were soon capable of transmitting and improving the lessons which they had imbibed. After a short succession of foreign teachers, the tide of emigration subsided. But the language of Constantinople was spread beyond the Alps, and the natives of France, Germany, and England imparted to their countries the sacred fire which they had kindled in the schools of Florence and Rome. In the productions of the mind, as in those of the soil, the gifts of nature are excelled by industry and skill. The Greek authors, forgotten on the banks of the Ilissus, have been illustrated on those of the Elbe and the Thames, and Bessarion, or Gaza, might have envied the superior science of the barbarians. The accuracy of Budaeus, the taste of Erasmus, the copiousness of Stevens, the erudition of Scaliger, the discernment of Reiske or of Bentley. On the side of the Latins, the discovery of printing was a casual advantage, but this useful art has been applied by Aldus and his innumerable successors to perpetuate and multiply the works of antiquity. A single manuscript imported from Greece is revived in 10,000 copies, and each copy is fairer than the original. In this form, Homer and Plato would peruse with more satisfaction their own writings, and their scholiasts must resign the prize to the labors of our Western editors. Before the revival of classic literature, the barbarians in Europe were immersed in ignorance, and their vulgar tongues were marked by the rudeness and poverty of their manners. The students of the more perfect idioms of Rome and Greece were introduced to a new world of light and science, to the society of the free and polished nations of antiquity, and to a familiar converse with those immortal men who spoke the sublime language of eloquence and reason. Such an intercourse must tend to refine the taste and to elevate the genius of the moderns. And yet, from the first experiments, it might appear that the study of the ancients had given fetters rather than wings to the human mind. However laudable, the spirit of imitation is of a servile cast, and the first disciples of the Greeks and Romans were a colony of strangers in the midst of their age and country. The minute and laborious diligence which explored the antiquities of remote times might have improved or adorned the present state of society. The critic and metaphysician were the slaves of Aristotle. The poets, historians, and orators were proud to repeat the thoughts and words of the Augustan age. The works of nature were observed with the eyes of Pliny and Theophrastus, and some pagan votaries professed a secret devotion to the gods of Homer and Plato. The Italians were oppressed by the strength and number of their ancient auxiliaries. The century after the deaths of Petrarch and Boccaccio was filled with a crowd of Latin imitators who decently repose on our shelves. But in that era of learning it will not be easy to discern a real discovery of science, a work of invention or eloquence in the popular language of the country. But as soon as it had been deeply saturated with the celestial dew, the soil was quickened into vegetation and life. The modern idioms were refined. The classics of Athens and Rome inspired a pure taste and a generous emulation. And in Italy, as afterwards in France and England, the pleasing reign of poetry and fiction was succeeded by the light of speculative and experimental philosophy. Genius may anticipate the season of maturity, but in the education of a people, as in that of an individual, memory must be exercised before the powers of reason and fancy can be expanded. Nor may the artist hope to equal or surpass till he has learned to imitate the works of his predecessors. Chapter 67 Schism of the Greeks and Latins. Reign and Character of Amurath II. Crusade of Ladislaus, King of Hungary. His Defeat and Death. John Hunyadis. Skanderbeg. Constantine Palaeologus, Last Emperor of the East. The respective merits of Rome and Constantinople are compared and celebrated by an eloquent Greek, the father of the Italian schools. The view of the ancient capital, the seat of his ancestors, surpassed the most sanguine expectations of Emmanuel Chrysoloras, and he no longer blamed the exclamation of an old sophist that Rome was the habitation, not of men, but of gods. Those gods and those men had long since vanished. But to the eye of liberal enthusiasm, the majesty of Rouen restored the image of her ancient prosperity. The monuments of the consuls and Caesars, of the martyrs and apostles, engaged on all sides the curiosity of the philosopher and the Christian. And he confessed that in every age the arms and the religion of Rome were destined to reign over the earth. While Chrysoloras admired the venerable beauties of the mother, he was not forgetful of his native country, her fairest daughter, her imperial colony, and the Byzantine patriot expatiates with zeal and truth on the eternal advantages of nature and the more transitory glories of art and dominion which adorned, or had adorned, the city of Constantine. Yet the perfection of the copy still redounds, as he modestly observes, to the honour of the original, and parents are delighted to be renewed and even excelled by the superior merit of their children. Constantinople, says the orator, is situated on a commanding point between Europe and Asia, between the archipelago and the Black Sea. By her interposition, the two seas and the two continents are united for the common benefit of nations, and the gates of commerce may be shut or opened at her command. The harbour, encompassed on all sides by the sea and the continent, is the most secure and capacious in the world. The walls and gates of Constantinople may be compared with those of Babylon. The towers, many. Each tower is a solid and lofty structure. Then the second wall, the outer fortification, would be sufficient for the defense and dignity of an ordinary capital. A broad and rapid stream may be introduced into the ditches, and the artificial island may be encompassed, like Athens, by land or water. Two strong and natural causes are alleged for the perfection of the model of New Rome. The royal founder reigned over the most illustrious nations of the globe, and in the accomplishment of his designs, the power of the Romans was combined with the art and science of the Greeks. Other cities have been reared to maturity by accident and time. Their beauties are mingled with disorder and deformity, and the inhabitants, unwilling to remove from their natal spot, are incapable of correcting the errors of their ancestors and the original vices of situation or climate. But the free idea of Constantinople was formed and executed by a single mind, and the primitive model was improved by the obedient zeal of the subjects and successors of the first monarch. The adjacent isles were stored with an inexhaustible supply of marble, but the various materials were transported from the most remote shores of Europe and Asia, and the public and private buildings, the palaces, churches, aqueducts, cisterns, porticos, columns, baths, and hippodromes were adapted to the greatness of the capital of the East. The superfluity of wealth was spread along the shores of Europe and Asia, and the Byzantine territory, as far as the Black Sea, the Hellespont, and the Long Wall, might be considered as a populous suburb and a perpetual garden. In this flattering picture, the past and the present, the times of prosperity and decay, are art fully confounded. But a sigh and a confession escape from the orator that his wretched country was the shadow and sepulchre of its former self. The works of ancient sculpture had been defaced by Christian zeal or barbaric violence. The fairest structures were demolished, and the marbles of Paros or Numidia were burnt for lime, or applied to the meanest uses. Of many a statue, the place was marked by an empty pedestal. Of many a column, the size was determined by a broken capital. The tombs of the emperors were scattered on the ground. The stroke of time was accelerated by storms and earthquakes, and the vacant space was adorned by vulgar tradition with fabulous monuments of gold and silver. From these wonders, which lived only in memory or belief, he distinguishes, however, the Porphyry pillar, the column and colossus of Justinian, and the church, more especially the dome of Santa Sophia. The best conclusion, since it could not be described according to its merits, and after it no other object could deserve to be mentioned. But he forgets that a century before, the trembling fabrics of the Colossus and the church had been saved and supported by the timely care of Andronicus the Elder. 30 years after, the emperor had fortified Santa Sophia with 2 new buttresses or pyramids, the eastern hemisphere suddenly gave way, and the images, the altars, and the sanctuary were crushed by the falling ruin. The mischief indeed was speedily repaired. The rubbish was cleared by the incessant labor of every rank and age, and the poor remains of riches and industry were consecrated by the Greeks to the most stately and venerable temple of the East. The last hope of the falling city and empire was placed in the harmony of the mother and daughter, in the maternal tenderness of Rome, and the filial obedience of Constantinople. In the Synod of Florence, the Greeks and Latins had embraced and subscribed and promised. But these signs of friendship were perfidious or fruitless, and the baseless fabric of the union vanished like a dream. The emperor and his prelates returned home in the Venetian galleys, but as they touched at the Morea and the isles of Corfu and Lesbos, the subjects of the Latins complained that the pretended union would be an instrument of oppression. No sooner did they land on the Byzantine shore than they were saluted, or rather assailed, with a general murmur of zeal and discontent. During their absence, above 2 years, the capital had been deprived of its civil and ecclesiastical rulers. Fanaticism fermented in anarchy. The most furious monks reigned over the conscience of women and bigots, and the hatred of the Latin name was the first principle of nature and religion. Before his departure for Italy, the emperor had flattered the city with the assurance of a prompt relief and a powerful succor, and the clergy, confident in their orthodoxy and science, had promised themselves and their flocks an easy victory over the blind shepherds of the West. The double disappointment exasperated the Greeks. The conscience of the subscribing prelates was awakened. The hour of temptation was past, and they had more to dread from the public resentment than they could hope from the favor of the emperor or the pope. Instead of justifying their conduct, they deplored their weakness, professed their contrition, and cast themselves on the mercy of God and of their brethren. To the reproachful question, what had been the event or the use of their Italian synod, they answered with sighs and tears, "Alas, we have made a new faith. We have exchanged piety for impiety. We have betrayed the immaculate sacrifice, and we are become Azymites." The Azymites were those who celebrated the communion with unleavened bread, and I must retract or qualify the praise which I have bestowed on the growing philosophy of the times. Alas, we have been seduced by distress, by fraud, and by the hopes and fears of a transitory life. The hand that has signed the union should be cut off, and the tongue that has pronounced the Latin creed deserves to be torn from the root. The best proof of their repentance was an increase of zeal for the most trivial rites and the most incomprehensible doctrines, and an absolute separation from all, without excepting their prince, who preserved some regard for honor and consistency. After the decease of the patriarch Joseph, the archbishops of Heraclea and Trebizond had courage to refuse the vacant office, and Cardinal Bessarion preferred the warm and comfortable shelter of the Vatican. The choice of the emperor and his clergy was confined to Metrophanes of Cyzicus. He was consecrated in Santa Sophia, but the temple was vacant. The cross-bearers abdicated their service. The infection spread from the city to the villages, and Metrophanes discharged, without effect, some ecclesiastical thunders against a nation of schismatics. The eyes of the Greeks were directed to Mark of Ephesus, the champion of his country, and the sufferings of the holy confessor were repaid with a tribute of admiration and applause. His example and writings propagated the flame of religious discord. Age and infirmity soon removed him from the world. But the Gospel of Mark was not a law of forgiveness, and he requested with his dying breath that none of the adherents of Rome might attend his obsequies or pray for his soul. The schism was not confined to the narrow limits of the Byzantine Empire. Secure under the Mameluke scepter, the three patriarchs of Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem assembled a numerous synod, disowned their representatives at Ferrara and Florence, condemned the creed and council of the Latins, and threatened the emperor of Constantinople with the censures of the Eastern Church. Of the sectaries of the Greek communion, the Russians were the most powerful, ignorant, and superstitious. Their primate, the Cardinal Isidore, hastened from Florence to Moscow to reduce the independent nation under the Roman yoke. but the Russian bishops had been educated at Mount Athos, and the prince and people embraced the theology of their priests. They were scandalized by the title, the pomp, the Latin cross of the legate, the friend of those impious men who shave their beards and perform the divine office with gloves on their hands and rings on their fingers. Isidore was condemned by synod. His person was imprisoned in a monastery, and it was with extreme difficulty that the cardinal could escape from the hands of a fierce and fanatic people. The Russians refused a passage to the missionaries of Rome who aspired to convert the pagans beyond the Tanais, and their refusal was justified by the maxim that the guilt of idolatry is less damnable than that of schism. The errors of the Bohemians were excused by their abhorrence for the Pope, and a deputation of the Greek clergy solicited the friendship of those sanguinary enthusiasts. While Eugenius triumphed in the union and orthodoxy of the Greeks, his party was contracted to the walls, or rather, to the palace of Constantinople. The zeal of Palaeologus had been excited by interest. It was soon cooled by opposition. An attempt to violate the national belief might endanger his life and crown. Nor could the pious rebels be destitute of foreign and domestic aid. The sword of his brother Demetrius, who in Italy had maintained a prudent and popular science, was half unsheathed in the cause of religion, and Amurath, the Turkish sultan, was displeased and alarmed by the seeming friendship of the Greeks and Latins. Sultan Murad, or Amurath, lived 49 and reigned 30 years, 6 months, and 8 days. He was a just and valiant prince, of a great soul, patient of labors, learned, merciful, religious, charitable, a lover and encourager of the studious, and of all who excelled in any art or science, a good emperor and a great general. No man obtained more or greater victories than Amurath. Belgrade alone withstood his attacks. Under his reign, the soldier was ever victorious, the citizen rich and secure. If he subdued any country, his first care was to build mosques and caravanserais, hospitals and colleges. Every year he gave 1,000 pieces of gold to the sons of the prophet, and sent 2,500 to the religious persons of Mecca, Medina, and Jerusalem. This portrait is transcribed from the Historian of the Ottoman Empire. But the applause of a servile and superstitious people has been lavished on the worst of tyrants, and the virtues of a sultan are often the vices most useful to himself or most agreeable to his subjects. A nation ignorant of the equal benefits of liberty and law must be awed by the flashes of arbitrary power. The cruelty of a despot will assume the character of justice, his profusion of liberality, his obstinacy of firmness. If the most reasonable excuse be rejected, few acts of obedience will be found impossible, and guilt must tremble where innocence cannot always be secure. The tranquility of the people and the discipline of the troops were best maintained by perpetual action in the field. War was the trade of the Janissaries, and those who survived the peril and divided the spoil applauded the generous ambition of their sovereign. To propagate the true religion was the duty of a faithful Muslim. The unbelievers were his enemies and those of the prophet. And in the hands of the Turks, the scimitar was the only instrument of conversion. Under these circumstances, however, the justice and moderation of Amurath are attested by his conduct and acknowledged by the Christians themselves, who consider a prosperous reign and a peaceful death as the reward of his singular merits. In the vigor of his age and military power, he seldom engaged in war till he was justified by previous and adequate provocation. The victorious sultan was disarmed by submission, and in the observance of treaties, his word was inviolate and sacred. The Hungarians were commonly the aggressors. He was provoked by the revolt of Skanderbeg, and the perfidious Karamanian was twice vanquished and twice pardoned by the Ottoman monarch. Before he invaded the Morea, Thebes had been surprised by the despot. Then the conquest of Thessalonica, the grandson of Bajazet, might dispute the recent purchase of the Venetians, and after the first siege of Constantinople, the Sultan was never tempted by the distress, the absence, or the injuries of Palaeologus to extinguish the dying light of the Byzantine Empire. But the most striking feature in the life and character of Amurath is the double abdication of the Turkish throne. And were not his motives debased by an alloy of superstition, we must praise the royal philosopher who at the age of 40 could discern the vanity of human greatness. Resigning the scepter to his son, he retired to the pleasant residence of Magnesia, but he retired to the society of saints and hermits. It was not till the 4th century of the Hegira that the religion of Mohammed had been corrupted by an institution so adverse to his genius. But in the age of the Crusades, the various orders of dervishes were multiplied by the example of the Christian and even the Latin monks. The Lord of Nations submitted to fast and pray and turn round in endless rotation with the fanatics who mistook the giddiness of the head for the illumination of the spirit. But he was soon awakened from his dreams of enthusiasm by the Hungarian invasion, and his obedient son was the foremost to urge the public danger and the wishes of the people. Under the banner of their veteran leader, the Janissaries fought and conquered, but he withdrew from the field of Varna, again to pray, to fast, and to turn round with his Magnesian brethren. These pious occupations were again interrupted by the danger of the state. A victorious army disdained the inexperience of their youthful ruler. The city of Adrianople was abandoned to rapine and slaughter, and the unanimous divan implored his presence to appease the tumult and prevent the rebellion of the Janissaries. At the well-known voice of their master, they trembled and obeyed, and the reluctant sultan was compelled to support his splendid servitude, till at the end of 4 years he was relieved by the angel of death. Age or disease, misfortune or caprice, have tempted several princes to descend from the throne, and they have had leisure to repent of their irretrievable step. But Amurath alone, in the full liberty of choice, after the trial of empire and solitude, has repeated his preference of a private life. After the departure of his Greek brethren, Eugenius had not been unmindful of their temporal interest, and his tender regard for the Byzantine Empire was animated by just apprehension of the Turks, who approached and might soon invade the borders of Italy. But the spirit of the Crusades had expired, and the coldness of the Franks was not less unreasonable than their headlong passion. In the 11th century, a fanatic monk could precipitate Europe on Asia for the recovery of the Holy Sepulchre. But in the 15th, the most pressing motives of religion and policy were insufficient to unite the Latins in the defense of Christendom. Germany was an inexhaustible storehouse of men and arms, but that complex and languid body required the impulse of a vigorous hand, and Frederick III was alike impotent in his personal character and his imperial dignity. A long war had impaired the strength, without satiating the animosity, of France and England. But Philip, Duke of Burgundy, was a vain and magnificent prince, and he enjoyed, without danger or expense, the adventurous piety of his subjects, who sailed in a gallant fleet from the coast of Flanders to the Hellespont. The maritime republics of Venice and Genoa were less remote from the scene of action,